wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing.
Hello and welcome to the Prison Voices Project. I'm Corey Fisher Hoffman, and today's program is going to focus on the best of 2013. So you'll hear a number of the produced segments about topics that were impacting the local community, or the statewide in New York, or in some cases, nationwide. So stay tuned to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM, Agra, Catskill, and Hudson to listen to a special Best of 2013 production. Enjoy.
The realm of freedom, then through death I escape to freedom, which is a quote by Fran Fanon. The title of this poem is A Defiant Voice. They removed my whisper from general population to maximum security. I gain a voice. They removed my voice from maximum security to administrative segregation. My voice gave hope. They removed my voice from administrative segregation to solitary confinement. My voice became vibration for unity. They removed my voice from solitary confinement to the supermax of Camp J. And now, they wish to destroy me. The louder my voice, the deeper they bury me. I said, the louder my voice, the deeper they bury me. Free all political prisoners, prisoners of war, prisoners of consciousness. Herman Wallace, Angle 3.
On Wednesday, February 13th, dozens of community members joined together at Time and Space Limited in Hudson to discuss the school-to-prison pipeline. Featured panelists Richard Smith, a Hudson local who left the community in handcuffs and after earning a master's degree in Africana Studies, now is studying and on his way to getting a PhD. Smith explains the school-to-prison pipeline.
I'm here to talk to you a little bit about this phenomenon called the school-to-prison pipeline. And what the school-to-prison pipeline is, it's a phrase to try to describe this continuum that intersects education and schools and the prison industry or the prison industrial complex. And the school-to-prison pipeline has come into the realm of the media's attention within the last 5 years or so because they started to recognize that there was this connection between young people's experiencing and particularly the urban schools and the prison system.
Richard Smith was joined by other panelists who have direct experience with the program that takes students deemed to be acting out and places them in the criminal justice system through the use of a PINS, or Person in Need of Supervision, petition. 18-year-old Vaughn discussed his experience of being placed on PINS as a 10-year-old and having to face a judge due to referrals for incidents such as being late to class. Other panelists included Anna, Vaughn's mother, who had also been placed on PINS, which she noted led to her eventual incarceration. Anna, Vaughn, and Richard were joined by Conchita, a Hudson resident who fought the school's attempt to place her nephew on PINS supervision and won. The panel was moderated by Linda Mussman of Time and Space Limited and attended by three members of the Hudson School Board and many concerned community members. Attendees discussed the racism within the school system and cited unequal treatment of students of color, lack of teachers who can identify with the struggles and experiences of their students or who are people of color, and lack of a curriculum that teaches students of color about their own history. After the event, I interviewed two high school students who were in attendance. Here's a clip from that interview.
I'm Amber Harris. I'm a sophomore at Hudson High School, and my aunt is on the school board, and that's where I heard about this. Students need to be here because only three students from Hudson High were here tonight, two of which are sitting here with you right now, which kind of saddens me because we are the ones who are affected by this. And I think that there's a lot of students who know what's going on and know what's involved. They just don't want to speak up because they think they're going to be shot down. I mean, there is a lot of like racism towards like the Middle Eastern kids, black kids. It's everybody who doesn't fit, you know, the upper middle class white person mold. You know, they're not from around here. They don't get the same respect as anyone else would. It's ridiculous. We've got people from all over the world, the United States, and we're still one of the most racist countries on earth. It's 2013. It's time we start bringing the people together, not separating them apart. We claim to be the land of the free and the land of, you know, everyone's accepted here, but that's a load of crap. So we just stop being so hypocritical about it.
Well, I'm Amanda Chaplin. I'm a sophomore at Hudson High. And, well, I never really heard of PINS before, but I never realized that the people who are in it really are being held back from their true potential. And I really think that, like, this talk was very helpful, but we need to get more of the community together so everybody hears and says what they need to say, and then we can all figure out a way to actually help the community instead of just talking about it and doing nothing.
I think the solution is, though, we need to start, you know, people who have gone to jail aren't just objects that have gone to trouble, or, you know, the kids who get in trouble in school who are in PINS aren't just people who get in trouble. They're doing this for a reason. Everyone does something for a reason. People just don't act out and do things because they want to. There's a psychological reason behind it, and no one wants to ask these social questions as to why. And that child struggles with that because no one seems to want to stop and help. Like Amanda said, if we bring the community together to show these people that these kids are doing it for a reason, maybe these kids will, like, okay, we realize what our potential is, we know what we can do. They'll go on to have successful lives and successful futures.
Nationally, the conversation on the school-to-prison pipeline has focused on zero-tolerance policy, increasing policing in schools, and the increased rates of incarceration. In Hudson, community members have identified, above all, one program, PINS, Person in Need of Supervision Petitions, as a main culprit in funneling children from the education system into the criminal justice system. For a feature program on this event, tune in to the Prison Voices Project on Thursday, March 14th from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM. For WGXC from Hudson, New York, I am Corey Fisher Hoffman. As summer approaches, many people are getting excited about gardening, hiking, and barbecues. Community members and school officials, on the other hand, are concerned about how a lack of structured activities often leads to rising crime rates. Continuing on the conversation about juvenile justice and a need to find alternatives to the PINS process, or Persons in Need of Supervision, Time and Space Limited in Hudson hosted a community panel exploring alternatives to the PINS system. The panel included Honorable Richard Kowick from Columbia County, and Mr. Lee Wynn, former director of Tyron Boys and former assistant director of Brookwood Secure Facility within the New York State Office of Children and Family Services. The panel was co-moderated by Linda Mussman of Time and Space Limited and guest moderator Mr. Andre Morris, a re-entry specialist with the Albany-based Trinity Alliance. Lee Wynn reflected on his experience working with incarcerated youth and their desire to actually be listened to.
Listen to me. I have something to say. I am smart. I am intelligent. I just need somebody to invest in me. Show me you care. I may piss you off the first time. You're like, forget that kid. Columbia County, Albany County, New York City, Mississippi, Georgia, I don't care where you are. People are people. You talk to people. Like I said, meet them where they are, but you know where you want to go. You got to meet them where they are first.
So what happens to these children that they are good kids and they're being intimidated by the adults and they happen to fall into the wrong hands or do the wrong things and they're not being explained and they're just being punished, sent away? And this is, to in my eyes, that's the training of becoming a professional criminal.
And then when you send them to these institutions like this, you already put in their mind that this is where they belong. So when you put them in their minds that this is what they want, when they come out, they're going to keep going and going, then they're going to end up in places.
That was Tiffany Grieca from the Staley B. Keith Social Justice Center and Andre Morris. Judge Coick expressed his enthusiasm for diversion programs based on his experience on the bench in city court.
One of the things I enjoyed about the city court bench, particularly with kids who did stuff that might be classified the first time through more as stupid than a crime, and they recognize it, is that I was a strong proponent of community service as a way to, as an alternative to a fine or an alternative to even a disposition. If you're willing to do some community service up front, then I'm willing to consider, with the consent of the district attorney, having the charge dismissed. And I think it was pretty effective.
Echoing Judge Coick, Quinton Cross of SBK stated a need for a diversion program for youth.
In order for us to provide an alternative, we must have an alternative. And I think it's definitely something to look at, because these kids are, you know, whether it's through the school or through the community, at the end of the day, it's prison. You know, it's just the first step to get to prison. And if we're serious about it, really needs to be some diversion programs and some alternatives out there.
One of the alternatives suggested was offered by Vera Michelson, who explained her work on a community accountability board in Albany.
When someone commits an offense, a nonviolent offense, the judge and the DA have to agree that this is the person that could go before the accountability board instead of going to jail. And the idea is to have them come. They have to understand what they're going to be doing, and they have to accept that, and they have to accept responsibility for the offense that they did. I mean, those are some of the things that have to happen in order to have a successful restorative justice process, and that's what the Community Accountability Board is. So they come, they meet with people from the community. All these people are trained. And they meet with people from the community. So it'd be one person and maybe three or four people. And these people are, you know, regular people from the neighborhoods. It's really good if you have somebody who's been on the block for, you know, maybe known as the auntie on the block or the grandma on the block, and she knows maybe the family, and it makes it really difficult. Sometimes they would rather go to jail than face that and have that conversation. So they come in, and you have 2 hours with the person. And they it's a method of how you get into this conversation. What happened? This is not supposed to be judgmental at all. Just tell us what happened. Make it like we were there, okay? So and how did you feel when this was going on? What were you thinking about? You know what? And then you just go. Some of you were talking about people don't ask questions. These are the questions nobody ever asks anybody either. What were you thinking? You know what was going on? What happened? Not what did you do and you shouldn't have done that, you know? So this starts the conversation, and it's can be pretty amazing what happens in that 2 hours. So if there Okay, so then it gets to another stage with what happened. What kind of harm do you think was created? So that's a difficult question sometimes for people to answer. So they may say, you know, well, it's obvious that they created harm to the girlfriend when they were trying to bang the door down and scared her or whatever. But maybe they didn't. Was anybody else around? So you start asking questions. You're always asking questions. Was anybody else around? Did anybody else see this? You know, well, I heard some crying down the hallway. Do you know if that was who that was? Well, I think it was a child. Oh, okay. And then, you know, they took you to jail. And then what happened? Who picked you up from jail? My mom. Was she working at the time? Did she leave? You know, so you just go through all these things that people don't think about. Towards the end of it, it's a question of how do you think that the repair can be made.
In search for a diversion program to reroute the school-to-prison pipeline, address the root causes of criminal behavior, and address larger community issues, the idea of restorative justice became the focus of the conversation. Howard Zare, an expert in restorative justice, speaks to the failings of the criminal justice system and to restorative justice, its strengths, in its ability to better meet the needs of victims of crimes.
One of the things I like about restorative justice is it's a way to help people stop and think about the assumptions they make every day, like the assumptions about justice, and to have a discussion about, well, what are the real needs in this situation and so forth. To me, one of the starting points is helping those in the criminal justice system understand what their system does right, but also what does wrong. And the criminal justice system does not do very much for victims. Often it re-traumatizes them. It doesn't hold offenders accountable in a meaningful sense, and by that I mean in the sense of taking responsibility, understanding what they did, taking responsibility for it. And it leaves out the larger community. In fact, it often re-victimizes or creates new wounds in the community. So there's some strength to the legal system, strengths to the criminal justice system, but it's got some pretty serious defects. And part of the key is just helping people to understand both of those things. There is also a large industry behind the criminal justice system that wants it to stay the way it is. Some people think that it sounds like it's soft on crime, whereas we know that it's really very difficult to take responsibility, but it looks like sometimes that maybe it's soft on crime. And some people just don't care about victims, frankly. I mean, it's not in their job description. So yeah, they admit that victims aren't being served well, but that's not my deal. That's not my job.
The following clip, pulled from a YouTube video on restorative justice process in a Lansing school district in Michigan, reviews the basic process.
Emotions can run high, but the facilitator works through the structured process to make sure an atmosphere of respect is maintained. The process is designed to get participants to think through three main points. The first is to gain a common understanding of the incident that brought them to the circle. This starts with the question, what happened? Next, the facilitator asks questions to help everyone understand who was affected by the incident and how they were affected. In the third and final part of the process, the facilitator helps the group make decisions about what needs to be done to heal the harm.
Principal Abitab of Hudson High was in attendance, and he stated an interest to work towards alternative diversions to PINs. Towards the end of the panel, the mood in the crowd was clear. Enough talking and time to put a plan into action. This is Claire Cousin.
I'm a little tired of sitting at these panels. I feel like everybody is speaking about what they know the issue is. We invite politicians to come that have the authority to change these things. We invite people from other counties that come. And so far this year, since we've started SBK, have given us lists and lists and lists of ways we could change this, but nothing's happened yet. Like, when does it start? When do we stop talking? Because everything that everybody has said, I've done that. I've been sent away for 30 days for something my parents could have handled, but they were talked into putting me on PINs, so then I was sent away into a facility for something that my parents could have handled themselves. Now I've came back from my evaluation. I dropped out of high school because I wasn't welcome. I have a child now. I'm a single mom. I've been in between different colleges. I still don't have this type of support that I feel like I need. But I see kids running around the community that are just like me. But when do they get the help that everybody's talking about they need? When are you guys going to start? When are we going to start? Instead of a panel every month from judges and commissioners and all these different people, when does it start?
Following the panel, members of Hudson City School District, the Staley B. Keith Social Justice Center, and the Reentry Task Force of Columbia County, as well as others, held an educational meeting where they reviewed different models of restorative justice and began brainstorming how to implement a process in the Hudson City School District. It looks like restorative justice is coming to Hudson, New York. From Hudson, New York, I am Corey Fisher Hoffman for the Prison Voices Project and WGXC. So, hello, you're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC at 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. And right now we have on the phone with us David Hill, who's Executive Director of the International Defense Committee for Leonard Peltier. David, welcome. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Corey. My pleasure.
So I just wanted to start off, I think there might be some listeners who don't know who Leonard Peltier is. So if you could just give a little background on who Leonard Peltier is, and then we'll talk about what the current situation of his case is.
Leonard Peltier is a man who's been in prison for 38 years, who by court adjudication was deemed guilty of a shootout on a reservation back in 1975. And what makes this case unique is every piece of evidence used to convict him has been proven false in court, yet he has not received another trial. He has not received pardon or clemency or parole or anything like that. And we've been trying to get him out for, 38 years. And we've had major people from all over the world sign on to asking for release of Leonard Peltier, Desmond Tutu of South Africa, Jesse Jackson, all kinds of people. And Bill Clinton almost let him out, and the FBI staged a major protest and visited with Clinton during his last time in office, and he backed down on letting him out. And, what's another thing that makes his case important to Americans is there were a number of constitutional violations in his trial. And this isn't just a Native American issue. It's an issue of freedom and justice throughout America for all people. Because if his case stands as a precedent, it means they can manufacture evidence, coerce witnesses, lie on the stand, visit with the judge before the trial, deny you a trial of your peers, hide exculpatory evidence, all sorts of things. And yet when you prove this, then they still keep you in there and you don't get a new trial or overturn the conviction or anything, which normally happens when these things are proven. But in his case, it hasn't taken place. And it is our belief and our knowing that historically this is what always happens to Indian people. Our people do 7 times more time in prison than other groups. Our youth are adjudicated and tried as adults 3 times more than other groups. And, the list goes on. And there's like 370-something treaties that are violated by the government every day feloniously. And the Constitution of the United States says treaty law is the supreme law of the land. And the Constitution is a treaty between the American people and our government. And if that is invalid or not recognized, then no person in America has true freedom. We have people now, people are afraid of their government, and that's not freedom.
So what is the work today that you are doing to help support Leonard Peltier in his continued and ongoing struggle?
What we're doing, well, it changes from time to time. 38 years we've had rollovers of people representing Leonard and working in the office and things like that. I mean, it's an ongoing struggle. The FBI is real adamant at maintaining their fear of Native Americans standing up against them in any way on the reservations and wherever. On reservations, you have tribal law, you have Bureau of Indian Affairs law, and then the supreme law is the FBI. And so anything that takes place on a federal reserve, it falls under federal government FBI. So, you know, they want to maintain that fear and that control. And historically, if they couldn't get the Indian they wanted, they got who they could. And the message out there is, it doesn't matter if you do something wrong or whatever, but if you're with somebody that does, or if you know of something somebody does, or any way connected to them, then they're going to get you with something and make it stick if there is a confrontation of some sort. And two men went on trial before Leonard and were acquitted by reason of self-defense. And every piece of evidence, or all the evidence that was pertinent to that case prior to and after, was allowed to be presented in court. When Leonard's case was brought to court, they moved his case from where the other two men had been tried to a judge who was more in line with FBI thinking. The FBI met with him. They'd bust the jurors back and forth to court with blacked out windows on a bus, you know, creating this climate of fear with them, which didn't happen in the first one. And they only allowed evidence from that day, not prior things like that. But where all the evidence was allowed to be presented, the men were acquitted by reason of self-defense. There were two agents were killed in this shootout that took place on Pine Ridge, 1975. And one young Indian man was killed. The next day after the shootout, the officer in charge, the FBI officer in charge, was relieved of duty. You know, and there's a whole bunch of things to this case that that are totally wrong for in the government's position on things. And, you know, our people have historically, and even now, you know, we're the poorest of the poor. We're 25% lower than the rest of America in the areas of poverty levels, you know. And we have, you know, on some of those reservations and in a lot of areas, the suicide rate among our children is 2 and 3 times the national average, and adults twice the national average. And some reservations, it's 6 or 7 times the national average. And, you know, the unemployment rate's high, a lot of these things. And these people, that day in Oglala, they were trying to build cabins, they were gardens, and they were opposing a tribal regime that wanted to sign away 1/8 of the reservation for gas, oil, and coal, and other mineral things. And they didn't want the reservation signed away. And they were fighting against that. And this tribal chairman had a goon squad that was going out and harassing people. And they drove unmarked cars, unmarked clothing. And these FBI agents come on there with unmarked cars and unmarked clothing and started a shootout. And two were killed, and they killed one Indian man. And it's, you know, this isn't an isolated incident. It's isolated in terms of agents getting killed, but in terms of harassment of Indian people and Indian people losing their lives. In that area, within the last 2 years prior to this and during that time, there was like 60 Indian people killed who were opposing that tribal chairman, and the FBI provided guns to these people. They looked the other way when they violated the law in hurting people and violating their civil rights and human rights and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's something that it's part of a 500-year war people have had to deal with, you know. And I think another thing that makes our cause a common cause for all people is that our position on ecology, our relationship with the earth, those things are what cause us to maintain the places we are and maintain who we are, because our culture is based in ecological responsibility and trying to live in harmony with the earth and things like that. And, you know, that's what keeps us together and keeps us as a people. But it's in opposition to corporations that want to, you know, just totally exploit nature for money. And you can see the result of that now with the climate changes and water being polluted and air is polluted and the soil is polluted and cancer and all these things. And we talked about those years and years ago. I think one famous speech by Chief Seattle, he said, man did not weave the web of life, but it's just merely a strand within it. What he does to the web, he does to himself. And he talked about a lot of other things. And a lot of chiefs and leaders and spiritual people and common Indian people said the same things, and sometimes even more eloquently and sincerely and things. And, you know, that's who we are. That's who we are in the past. That's who we are today. That's who we'll be tomorrow. And Leonard Peltier is at the forefront of this because his case stands as a precedent, not just for Indian people, but for all Americans, because it was violations of the Constitution. And we were part of the Constitution. As of 1924, we became citizens. We were fighting for this country before we were even considered citizens of it. The first code talkers, you know, the only code talkers that were Native Americans, you know, the Choctaw, Navajo, Comanche, several other tribes were code talkers starting World War One. And, you know, there's a lot of depth to Leonard Peltier's case and support all over the world, but this country hasn't wanted to look at itself and wants to point the finger at somebody else, some other country, talk about their political prisoners, but they got three fingers pointing back at them when they do that. And we need to recognize that Leonard Peltier is an important issue in this country. And another thing that's real important, I think, that Americans need to recognize is that this country, the judicial system, is no longer has anything that has to do with justice. It has to do with money. The judicial system has become an industrialized situation. It's becoming industrialized. And, you know, there's no justice if all that's required is money. You know, I know of cases after cases where people, if they had money, they wouldn't have gone to prison. 95% of the people who go to prison plead guilty. They end up with court-appointed attorneys who make money out of just prolonging it, then they get them to plead guilty, you know, an open-ended plea or some kind of plea bargain, and they become afraid to fight for the truth because they might end up getting more time, you know. And America has more people in prison than any place else in the world, and I think more than all combined. And like Oklahoma has more women in prison than anywhere in the world, the second largest population of prison in the United States. And, you know, the list goes on and on. So, you know, to listeners out there, a lot of people think, oh, it's not me, you know, but it always reminds me of a story I read one time, and it says how this man said, first they came for the communists, and I wasn't a communist. They came for the socialist, and I wasn't a socialist, and they came for the Jews, and I wasn't a Jew. I did nothing. And then they came for me, and there was no one left. And, you know, Americans are going to face the same thing if they don't start doing something about it. You know, this we don't have a democracy anymore. We get to vote for the puppet of our choice. You might call it a puppetocracy or something, but I think they call it a plutocracy when the corporations run a country. That's what's happening now. And Americans need to become involved to do something about it. Tomorrow might be their son, their daughter, their mother, their father, their sister, auntie, or grandmother or something. I know of grandmothers getting sentenced to 3 years for something they didn't even do. They just drug it out for a long time until they finally pled guilty. In Oklahoma, where I'm from, there was an Indian woman here recently got 12 years for selling $31 worth of pot. She worked two jobs, had four kids, never been in trouble. They hired a guy to come and try to get her to buy him some pot because they had him under charges, and they would give him a break if he could get somebody else. And just as a favor, she went and picked him up some from somebody she knew. They gave her 12 years for it. and it took us about 2 years to get her out of prison for it. And, you know, that's just one example. I mean, there's example after example all over the country. And, you know, I can't say that I know the answer for fixing it, but I know the answer for not, for letting it continue and get worse is that's to do nothing.
Let me just remind our listeners that right now we are listening to David Hill, Executive Director of the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, and you're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. David, thank you so much for all that you have shared. I have another question for you, which is what can listeners, people who are listening right now, who are wondering how they could get involved in Leonard's case, in his defense work, or just in general in some of the other themes that you talked about so far? How can people get involved, and where can they go to find out more information?
Well, we have an office, and we have a website that we're in the process of changing it right now, but it's getting up to speed. The address right now for our office in Florida, it's in Florida, it's the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. That's International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. It's at 1035 Pimera Boulevard, P-I-M-E-R-A Boulevard. That's 1035 Pimera Boulevard, Suite 1041. That's 1041 Lake Mary, Florida. That's Suite 1041. Lake Mary, Florida, and the zip is 32746, 32746. And, you know, if you don't get involved with us, there's lots of organizations around to get involved with, and we all kind of know of each other and work together when we can and whenever necessary and things like that. But, you know, people need to think about it, pray about it, and make that part of, make their religion or their quest for spirituality something more than just bowing your head and praying. You know, you got to put legs on your prayers. You got to do something. You know, the greatest form of worship is to do something that's right and right what's wrong. That's real honoring the Creator and the creation. You know, take care of what we were given. One of the things we're given was freedom and a clean earth, clean air, clean water, and we need to gain back what we lost and protect what we have.
Well, thank you so much, David. You were just listening to David Hill, Executive Director of the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, and you can put that into Google and get their website and find out more information. You can also go to Who is Leonard Peltier, spelled PELTIER.info to get more information. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, Thank you, Corey. We really appreciate the work that you're doing and the others out there that are doing the similar work and those listening and those who are about to get involved right now. Take care.
Take care. Thank you so much, David.
Bye-bye.
Yeah! Hudson Pride is a festive event which includes a march down Warren Street and a family-friendly festival with performances at the Waterfront Park. This year, the Brooklyn-based Rude Mechanical Orchestra, or RMO, joined other musical groups, floats, and marching bands in the parade down Warren Street. But the RMO had a specific message that pushed the bounds of this year's Pride Parade.
Prisons, drug laws, shut them down. We don't need no prisons down.
Wearing fun outfits reminiscent of the 1950s milkman, although with much more style, RMO partnered with a grassroots organization called Milk Not Jails to bring their message to the streets of Hudson. This is Zach.
We're just passing out pamphlets for Milk Not Jails, and Milk Not Jails is just like a grassroots organization based around trying to promote rural agriculture and trying to support small farmers in order to fight back against the prison industrial complex. What you see in New York a lot of times is urban people are targeted and criminalized and put into prisons, and the rural places are where these prisons pop up, like Hudson. So we're trying to promote the rural agricultural industry because New York has the third largest dairy industry actually in the state or in the United States. So we're trying to promote that in order to fight back against incarceration being a jobs program.
I asked Lauren Melodia, organizer with Milk Not Jails, to explain why they chose the Hudson Pride Parade as a venue for their campaign.
We want to reach out to people here in Hudson at Pride and let them know about the urban-rural alliance we're building for the local food system and to think beyond the prison economy. We thought it would be a great opportunity to reach out to progressively minded people here in Hudson. Maybe let people know that there is a prison right down the street here in Hudson if they don't already know that. 90% of the prisons in New York State are in rural areas, and so they create and provide a lot of jobs in those communities. And we know that a lot of politicians that represent those communities they see their communities dependent on the prisons, and they want to make sure that those jobs are there. What we're trying to do is demonstrate that there's other rural economic opportunities like farming. The prison industry doesn't have economic growth attached to it. Or if it did, then we're looking at a rise in crime and a rise in incarceration. Do we really want that as New Yorkers? Probably not.
Chanting erotic pleasures, decorations, no more mass incarceration. The Rude Mechanical Orchestra took the stage at Waterfront Park.
With Milk Not Jails. We are based in Brooklyn, New York. We are so happy to be here with Hudson Pride. So thank you very much for having us from Brooklyn. We really want to work on creating more of a rural-urban partnership between Hudson and New York City around issues that matter to all of us. Have a wonderful day. Happy Pride.
Well, we're hoping that we can build connections inside and outside of those prison walls and between upstate and downstate. We're a grassroots movement, and we're trying to create an alternative here in New York State to the prison economy, and we really need people here in the Hudson Valley to participate in that with us. So, you know, check us out at milknotjails.org or give us a call and join us.
From Hudson, New York, I am Corey Fisher Hoffman with the Prison Voices Project.
Which appears in this text and which is usually translated as sin, literally just means to miss the mark. Jesus shakes us up in this passage with the realization that when one person is excluded from the fullness of life, cut off from community, we all suffer. Without our brother, without our sister, there can be no justice. There can be no reconciliation or restoration. We are not whole. We are not complete. In the end, Jesus seems to say, wherever the blame lies, it is not just our responsibility to reclaim our brothers and sisters and to restore relationship. It is the sacred human call on which our common life depends. Even in the most constrained and insecure places in the human condition, there are choices to be made. Even if all we can change is our thinking, each one of us has agency. But Jesus also tempers that emphasis throughout his ministry with a fierce critique and confrontation with empire, with structural sin, with the systems of domination that keep poor people poor and push to the margins, that dehumanize and imprison. He confronted the representatives of these systems every opportunity he got and proclaimed to them and to all people the coming of a new kind of system, a new reign that would turn the status quo upside down, which is to say, right side up. It was his commitment to this message, to speaking truth to power, that led to his own arrest, trial, and execution.
On this night, we meditate on how these things continue to resonate in our community and in our world. As we look towards Easter, you're invited tonight to consider and to imagine what our liberation might look like.
In the upper room.
In the upper room.
Again, I missed the mark plenty of times. And me missing my mark cost me 17 years in prison. I remember almost getting to the point of getting released. And again, the fear came, terror came. You know, can I do this? Can I go back out there and stop this cycle? I was terrified. Can I go out and be the father that I should be? Can I go out and be the friend that I should be, the neighbor that I should be? And I didn't know what the answer was. You know, this is someone that, you know, lived in arrogance for years, you know, creating something that wasn't true, and had the goal to really live it out, you know, to really try to live it out. I was terrified again. I came home. I remember my daughter was coming to see me in prison. She's 4 years old now. She was coming to see me. She was 2, 3 years old. She was coming to see me. And, it used to break me up that she used to cry when she was inside, you know, the prison scene. You know, she didn't like the door shut. She always would jump. She didn't really want to come sit on my lap. She talked maybe one or two words the whole time we were there, things like that. So I had to make a decision that she didn't have to come anymore because it wasn't about me. And when I came home, through the grace of God, I ended up getting custody of my daughter and my son. 4 and 3 years old. And I can remember me asking my daughter, do she come? Because she acted like it never happened, that she was coming to see me. And I started thinking, you know, maybe she don't remember. So let me ask her. And I asked her, do you remember coming to see Daddy while I was in jail, when I had the green on? And she told me no, and walked off. I recognized it as for what it was. She didn't want to talk about it, you know. So I asked her again. I gave it a little while, and I asked her again. And she sat down, and she said, Daddy, I remember, but that's not you anymore. And she was 4 years old when she told me this. And it seemed like the chains came off of me at that time. A four-year-old forgave me for putting her through the things that she went through.
We all have a story to tell, and we're gathered here this evening to weave together our common narratives. I invite you now to one at a time, stand up, speak your truth, come forward and light your candle, and return to your seat.
For anyone who has been given an unfair trial.
For rural communities to develop alternative strategies for development.
For inmates who suffer from coercion or exploitation.
So that we might become equipped to advocate on behalf of those with no voice.
For anyone who doesn't know their rights.
For those returning home from prison that they find acceptance and belonging in our community.
For anyone who has ever been a victim of crime.
For hope that there is a life waiting beyond prison walls.
For employers to add discrimination in their hiring practice.
For the over 70,000 young people who are in juvenile detention centers.
For our country, which has the highest rate of incarceration in the entire world.
For affordable housing to be made available to those leaving prison.
For better and improved services and programs in jail, and for all those who serve in prisons doing therapy, spiritual care, work with the arts, education, and literacy. And for our community to open its hearts and minds for anyone trying to make a better life for themselves and their families.
For freedom,
for all children who face incarceration of their parents.
For anyone who has inadequate representation in court.
To recognize people as people and not to define them based on how many marks they've missed or any wrong paths they've gone on in their lives.
For people with a severe mental illness that run into the criminal justice system, who are twice as likely to be injured, who are less likely to be able to get parole because their symptoms keep them from conforming to prison rules, who don't belong there, as indeed who does. I want to share that I learned today that in New York State, we now have a ruling that persons with severe mental illness cannot be confined in solitary confinement. So there is hope and there is progress. And I want to share a vision and a prayer that in recognizing the needs of these innocents and providing for more humane treatment for them, that they will be like the little children that lead us to more humane treatment for all people.
For anyone on death row.
This is for the immigrant, for the people that come from another country, come here to make a living.
For my niece Brenda, that she may be able to forgive herself someday, that her children will forgive her someday, and that she will come to know that she is forgiven. And for a criminal justice system that seeks to restore rather than punish.
For a movement to end mass incarceration and the new Jim Crow.
For all children who suffer abuse and neglect.
For a change in our laws and policies that deliver much higher sentences to African Americans, to people of color, than they do to white folks. For a change in the system that allows people to vote and to have a say. And for the courage to speak up and to change these things.
For an end to racial profiling.
For children and teens who are profiled.
For their background, for their race, for their status.
For anyone who has to travel a significant distance to visit a loved one in jail.
For women who are pregnant and giving birth in prison, some of whom are still shackled to this day as they give birth.
For those awaiting trial.
So my name is Joni Hunt, and I thought this event was wonderful. I really didn't know what to expect coming here, but I thought it was a great, great message and a great topic to focus on in this time. And my message was to recognize people as people and not to define them based on a mark that they may have missed or a wrong turn they may have taken, but to really recognize people as human beings regardless of where they are in their lives. That's my message.
My name is Tamaya. It was fun because I got to blow a can bomb.
Yes, my name is Quentin Cross, and this was a wonderful event. To me, it was just a humbling experience because I've never seen anything like this happen, and it was so quick, so subtle, but it was so powerful because our prayers were, you know, to uplift and to pause and take a moment to think about the effects of incarceration. Good, bad, or indifferent, why you're there, why you're not there, doesn't matter. Just look at the human spirit and that we all should care for each other. So.
We will not bow down to a high racism. Yeah. We will not bow down to injustice. We will not bow down to exploitation. What you gonna do? I'm gonna stand.
You just heard the voices and prayers of community members,
at the Good Friday Vigil for those whose lives have been touched by incarceration at the First Presbyterian Church in Hudson, New York. Earlier in this piece, you heard the voices of Reverend Peyton from St. Peter's Presbyterian Church in Spencertown, Reverend Bilkey from the First Presbyterian Church in Hudson, and sharing his own personal story, Cedric Fulton from the Staley B. Keith Social Justice Center in Hudson, New York. From Hudson, this is Corey Fisher Hoffman with the Prison Voices Project and WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM.
Injustice, we will not obey. Exploitation, I'm gonna stand.
My understanding is that the education comes from the Latin word educare, which means to lead or to draw out. Paulo Freire talks about in the pedagogy of the oppressed, the banking system. That's what we're dealing with now. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with a system where students are considered to be empty vessels that need to be filled with information that's relevant to the people who have the power to educate them and train them in preparation to fit into this economic system. We know that, mm-hmm. right? And so I'll say something. So you're absolutely right. We need to develop alternative, if not some type of curriculums that we can use and in conjunction with that, right? Because that's right, exactly. So I'll say from a personal narrative. So I told you that I left this city in handcuffs, right? I left the city in handcuffs on my way to jail and eventually prison. And one of the things that it took for me as an individual, and this is why Africana studies, she mentioned earlier that my master's degree is in Africana studies. But my study of ancient African history and African American history did not begin in a classroom. It began inside of a cell. After the brothers got tired of sliding a message to the black man underneath my door, and I kept sliding it back out because I didn't want to read it, I didn't want to hear it, I didn't care about it, because at that point, I did internalize all of these notions about who I was, and it was completely diametrically opposed to what that book was telling me I was. But it wasn't until I opened that book and that opened my mind and I realized who I was and what my potential was beyond all of these stereotypical notions of blackness that I had internalized, that I was inundated with within this society, that I started to develop an alternative means to define myself as a black man. And then their bachelor's degree was a cinch for me. Their master's degree was a cinch for me. And now in a PhD, it's not that challenging for me because it started with the impetus that stemmed from an understanding of who I was, what my potential is, and my capabilities that allowed me to be able to actualize it wherever you put me. And that's the same thing that many of our students are lacking. You're absolutely right, especially our students of color, right? But, just to bring it back into this conversation, because you're right, that's another. So when we go back to solutions, right, when you talk about solutions, and there was one thing I think I didn't cover it. Restorative justice processes, right? So we talk about how many people are familiar with restorative justice programs. We're all aware of the criminal justice, right? Which is basically punitive in nature. Restorative justice is an opposition to that. It is an opportunity when a young man does something like come to school the ninth. We don't involve the courts in this process because we know that their role is to what? Protect them and keep the community safe, and it's a criminal punitive institution. That's their purpose. Restorative justice means we get the community involved. So in a case where a young man like Vaughn gets shown to have a knife in his pocket, we don't send him to the court system. We bring him to a place like here. We bring him to TSL, and we say, you know what? We're going to have him confront the community because now the people who are really affected by it are not this court system, are not the education system. It's the community, because every time a young man like him gets sent to the court system, we lose him. We lose valuable assets that our community becomes deprived of. So we need to create a restorative process so that we can help them reintegrate and figure out what's going on. Because if Vaughn would have came into a situation like this and had the opportunity to confront and confess what he did to all of you, your questions would not have been related to trying to fit him into the system. Your questions would have been related to trying to figure out what is wrong with this young man. Because this is not what he's supposed to be doing. Right? So this is what we need to implement. We need to implement restorative justice processes so that we can get the criminal justice system out of the picture. And then within those restorative justice processes, we can implement a program that teaches, or a school that teaches them about who they are and what their true potential is, as a means to avoid them from being locked away in this prison nation where we have over 2.5 million people incarcerated, and we have the largest prison population on the planet with multiple billion-dollar industry, where all types of, from lawyers to DAs, all of these people capitalize and profit off of our suffering, or the suffering of young people like everyone on this panel and people in here, because in some way, we have all been affected by the criminal justice system. We've all been affected by the prison system, right? So it is imperative that we think of solutions, not for the purpose of just being politically correct, because you can't legislate morality, but for the purpose of preserving and saving our community and saving the most precious assets of our community, which is our young people.
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart.